Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
So good afternoon. Today we're going
to WBUR. We interrupt here and now to bring you live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's daily coronavirus briefing from the State House.
We know we've asked a lot of the residents of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and we're very appreciative that everyone has done their part to stay home, social distance, and do without the special events, family gatherings, and the many other functions that used to define our day-to-day. The reason we're taking these measures is to flatten the curve of COVID-19, protect our friends and our families, and avoid steep spikes in cases that could overwhelm our healthcare system. Our goal is to prevent the spread and save as many lives as possible, especially for those vulnerable populations who become infected with this insidious disease. We've been working with the command center, with FEMA, with MEMA, our hospitals, and our medical advisory committee to put together a plan to address the Commonwealth's surge. We've estimated the impact of the surge through modeling that's based largely on Wuhan, China. But to paraphrase Dr. Ann Klebanski, the CEO of Partners Healthcare, who spoke here yesterday, these models are simply that, models. They may change, and they're not a perfect indicator of how this virus will impact our Commonwealth. So much depends on how much everyone stays home, practices good personal hygiene, and keeps their distance. Our models suggest that Massachusetts will hit surge sometime between today, April 10th, and April 20th. Data in recent days suggest the peak might be closer to April 20th. This is consistent with other publicly available models that are out there. And as new data comes in, we'll continue to assess our projections and make adjustments. Our model puts the peak around 2,500 new confirmed cases per day. Yesterday, we reported 2,100 new cases. If we do not see a flattening in the daily cases and in new hospitalizations, we may need to make some adjustments in our planning, and we will. At this time, we see evidence that we're still on the upward slope of this pandemic. For example, yesterday was our single biggest day for positive tests at 2,151. This partly reflects our active testing of hotspot nursing facilities, and we conducted well over 7,000 tests, which is a big increase for us. But yesterday was still the most confirmed positive test we've had on a single day to date. As I said on Wednesday, the percent of people testing positive has increased over the last few weeks. It reached a new high on Monday, which about 30% of all tests conducted were positive, and has remained high throughout the week, and despite the increase in tests. Yesterday, 29% of our tests were positive, even though we hit 7,000 tests overall. Unfortunately, we've also seen a continued growth in fatalities associated with this virus, with 70 new fatalities yesterday. Our case fatality rate is 2.7%, but it's growing. Still remains below the national average, about 3.5% in many European countries. For example, Italy, Spain, the Netherlands, UK, and France are all above 10%. Hospitalizations are also increasing. But we continue to believe that social distancing, staying home, shutting down non-essential services, and other measures that we and you have taken to flatten the curve are our best weapons against this pandemic. As we get into this projected surge, it's critically important that people heed our guidance and stay home as much as possible. I can't overemphasize how critical this is. Please stay home and only go out if you absolutely have to. If you need to go out, it should only be for the essential activities like going to the grocery store, the pharmacy, or checking in on a healthcare appointment. We urge you to remember to maintain social distancing guidelines, or to cover your face or wear a mask if you cannot maintain a safe distance from other people. Today, we're issuing a Department of Public Health advisory that, consistent with the CDC guidance, recommends that people wear a mask or cover their face in public when they cannot safely socially distance. This protects you from others and protects others from you. It works both ways. For example, we advise people to wear something to cover their face in public spaces and especially in places like supermarkets and pharmacies. If people need to go for a walk or a run, but they should certainly avoid group sports or anything where you're hanging out with lots of other people. That means no sitting around at the beach and no backyard cookouts with friends. If you go out, do what you have to do and go home. That's it. The first step in planning for the COVID-19 outbreak was assessing the capacity of the different levels of care in our existing hospital system statewide. We've been in contact with our hospitals on a daily basis to work on what we describe as a baseline capacity to support both ICU bed and acute bed needs. Our hospitals have done a tremendous job of maximizing their own capacity, but our projections have indicated that we need more beds, more staffed beds. That's why we've also been working to open new hospital care sites in all corners of the Commonwealth. Over the last several weeks, that work has accelerated. We've built out the Commonwealth's capacity significantly and for all types of patients. For example, COVID-19 can make elderly individuals or those with pre-existing conditions very sick, often requiring an ICU level of care. For others, COVID-19 may require hospitalization for a few days, but a less intensive level of care to keep the patient stable and comfortable as they recover. The plan we've put together accounts for different levels of care, and the concept that a patient may stay in an ICU bed in a hospital but become stable enough to move to an acute bed in a different setting in order to make that ICU bed available for somebody else was a big part of our planning. Even if we stay below our projections for confirmed diagnoses, we could still meet or exceed our projections for medical care if more people need hospitalization or stay longer in the hospital than anticipated. Some hospitals have seen a rapid increase in hospitalization rates in a short time. This is why surge planning is so important. The command centers work to make approximately 14,500 treatment beds available statewide. This comes from both hospitals building out their own capacity and by standing up field hospitals at places like the Boston Convention Center. Before this pandemic, 11,000 beds were readily available for ICU care and acute care in Massachusetts. This represents a breakdown of roughly 9,400 acute care beds and 1,500 ICU beds. In addition, through hospital surge planning and our field hospitals, we're bringing approximately 3,500 additional beds online for ICU care and acute care. This breaks down to approximately 2,500 new hospital beds coming online from hospital surge planning and 1,000 beds coming online through our field hospitals. To put a finer point on it, our current models have suggested that Massachusetts should have a target of 2,700 ICU beds available, with approximately 2,200 available for COVID patients. We'll continue to expand this capacity with our hospitals if necessary as we move forward. In the coming days, we'll have hundreds of new beds coming online that will help us significantly ramp up our capacity ahead of the surge to support our hospitals. We're targeting 5 alternative care sites or temporary hospitals. These field hospitals will serve as an alternative site for hospitals to treat patients, particularly individuals who need acute or less intensive care. They're being built or planned all around the state to ensure all of our residents have access to health care. Yesterday, we delivered an update on the BCEC site in Boston, which will open today. The DCU Center in Worcester also opened this week, and the Newton Pavilion in Boston started accepting patients yesterday. Over the coming week, we expect additional facilities to open up on the Cape and in Merrimack Valley, and we may have additional facilities available in Springfield at some point later on. All in, these facilities will provide approximately 1,000 additional beds for patients who do not require ICU level of care. As a message to the folks at home, if you're a patient experiencing a medical emergency, you should go to the nearest emergency room. But remember, if it's not an emergency, contact your healthcare provider before showing up at a healthcare facility. I've talked to many physicians over the course of the last several weeks, and they have taken full advantage, along with their patients, of our new telehealth benefit that's made available here in Massachusetts as a covered service to everybody. It is, in many respects, the fastest, quickest, and for you, and in many cases for your provider, the fastest way to engage in a conversation if you need to talk to your clinician. We're also instructing ambulances to follow their normal dispatching and triage protocols. Hospitals will stabilize patients and determine their best treatment course and site of care. This effort over the course of a few weeks will add hundreds and hundreds of new beds to our healthcare system and has not been an easy one. It takes a lot of planning and a ton of hard work and a lot of cooperation. We're very grateful to our federal partners and to the hospital systems at UMass Memorial, Partners Healthcare, Beth Israel Lahey, Cape Cod Hospital, Bay State Hospital, and Lowell General for their efforts to stand these up. These organizations and the doctors, nurses, and countless other workers are all stepping up big time, and we can't thank them enough. We're also monitoring the impact the virus is having in different regions and tracking how many beds are still available in each corner of the state. If there's a surge or a hot spot in one region, we'll have a plan in place to utilize hospital space or transport patients if we need to, depending on the level of care they require. Over the last few days, we have seen an increase in the number of hospitalizations. Our hospitals have reported that 8,100 beds are occupied now statewide, which is roughly 55% of capacity. This includes hospitalizations for non-COVID patients as well. That means we have about 6,400 available hospital beds for both ICU and acute care. That's roughly 45% of the total number of beds that are available right now. Thanks to everything we are all doing to stay home, practice good hygiene, and the incredible work of our medical community, capacity is manageable right now. But what we're seeing in the models predicts a big increase in cases in the weeks ahead. And that means our healthcare system will be stretched like never before. We will continue to engage with our healthcare community on a daily basis to monitor this number closely and keep the public informed with respect to capacity. And as we prepare for the surge, we're also chasing more PPE, or personal protective equipment, to keep our frontline health care workers safe and support patient needs. PPE remains a major challenge nationwide. We've been aggressively pursuing every avenue we can to make sure we have the gear that we need to protect our frontline workers as they battle the surge. We've made over 1,100 deliveries of over 2.6 million pieces of PPE to healthcare facilities, municipalities, and first responders since the outbreak began. And we'll keep working to get more into the hands of those on the front line that need it most. Healthcare workers, as everybody knows, are the front lines of the COVID-19 battle. As we grow our hospital capacity and stand up field hospitals, we need more healthcare workers to join those front lines. The command center set up an online portal called Mass Response, and we're currently seeking additional skilled volunteers to support the Commonwealth's efforts. So far, over 4,000 volunteers have signed up. Not a surprise, based on all we know about the people of the Commonwealth. But we could use more. Mass Response needs volunteers of all skill levels and backgrounds from both medical and non-medical professions. If you're a licensed or certified healthcare provider, a public health professional, a retiree, or an individual with an interest in helping your community, please visit the website, maresponds.org. We've also stood up a website posting employment opportunities for our temporary care sites and for our long-term care facilities at mass.gov/joincovidteam. This site will continually be updated with new job opportunities. In a minute, you all will hear from Kate Walsh, who's the CEO of Boston Medical Center. to share some thoughts on how her hospital is preparing for the surge. I do want to thank Kate and all of the Commonwealth's hospitals, their leaders, and their teams for being great partners with us and leaders in their communities. But before Kate comes up to the podium, I want to share one more thought with everyone today. I know this week and this weekend represent a challenging and complicated time for people of faith. The minister at our church always refers to this time of year as his Super Bowl. But not this year. For me, this will be the first Easter I haven't spent with either my mom or dad in at least 50 years. And I'm sure my dad and I will talk on the phone, but it will certainly not be the same. And it's cruel that at a time when we need hugs the most, staying apart is the most important thing that we can do for one another. This week, for our friends celebrating Easter and Passover, this week is about beating cruelty with love. We remember how to confront fear with faith. And regardless of whether you celebrate a holiday this week or not, we've all been doing a lot of that for the past few weeks, fighting a cruel force with love for one another and faith that what we do today will make tomorrow better. Now is not the time to give up or give in. Now is the time to help each other, to help the elderly, to help our frontline workers, to help those battling sickness. And we do that by sticking with what we know works and following through and staying together. And let me just close by saying, as I said at the beginning, please stay home. Look after one another and do all the things we've talked about, everything we can do to stop the spread. Thank you. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Kate Walsh from Boston Medical.
This is WBUR. You're listening to live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's daily coronavirus briefing.
Thank you, Governor Baker, and thank you, Secretary Sutters and Lieutenant Governor Polito. Boston Medical Center is very grateful to all of you for doing so much to flatten the curve. It is the most important thing we can do, and for also ensuring that every hospital has the information, the flexibility, and the resources to respond to this crisis. Your leadership, collaboration, and advocacy in Washington and across the Commonwealth have really been instrumental. We're particularly grateful at Boston Medical Center for the financial relief package, the infusion of funds that will ensure that hospitals, particularly safety net hospitals like ours, are here through this crisis and beyond for our patients and communities. BMC has already seen a dramatic drop in revenue, which is particularly tough for a place like ours. The governor's financial relief package will help bridge that gap over the next 3 months in communities all across our Commonwealth. So thank you, Governor Baker and Secretary Sutters. Now I'd like to update you on BMC's surge planning. When it became clear that Massachusetts would feel the impact of COVID-19, we knew that Boston Medical Center's patients, some of the most vulnerable in our region, would be hit the hardest. Many of our patients have to continue to work. They are essential workers. Cleaning buildings, preparing food, stocking shelves, loading trucks. They don't have the option of staying home. Many have pre-existing health conditions that put them at further risk. A large proportion of our patients live in multi-generational housing, and some are homeless. BMC quickly mobilized, first, to reorganize our campus to maximize capacity for COVID-19 patients, and second, to reduce the risk to the most vulnerable, the homeless people amongst us, and increase access to care for everyone. We immediately canceled all elective surgeries and routine ambulatory activity. We created a clinic to screen and test patients with flu-like symptoms. We converted beds across the hospital to almost double our ICU capacity and expand our medical surgical bed capacity for COVID-19 patients. We've repurposed endoscopy suites and post-operative recovery space. We transferred our pediatric inpatients to Boston Children's Hospital, thank you, and as a result, we have a number of adult patients in some brightly colored rooms. These steps, along with really hard work to assure appropriate staffing and to secure much-needed supplies, especially PPE, have allowed us to flex up significantly to meet demand. And as expected, BMC's volume began to surge earlier than other hospitals, leading us last Sunday to transfer some of our more stable ICU patients to other hospitals so we would have space to admit new patients. Thankfully, that was a one-day phenomenon, but it strengthened my resolve and that of my colleagues who run hospitals in Boston to put even more focus on coordination and to come together as a system of providers to maximize resources and save lives. One factor in the high volume BMC is seeing is for all the reasons I mentioned earlier. This virus is hitting certain racial and ethnic groups harder. At our hospital, 80% of our COVID-19 patients are Black or Hispanic, compared to about 58% normally. That's why the kind of support we're getting from Governor Baker and Mayor Walsh and their teams is really critical. We have to fight this virus both inside our hospitals, but also outside the walls of our hospital, so we can make absolutely certain that access to COVID-19 care is equitable across all racial and ethnic groups. We also need to make sure we're doing everything we can to bend the curve across all racial and ethnic groups. And we've produced material encouraging social distancing in 10 languages, and we're working with Mayor Walsh, the Boston delegation, Boston City Council, and community partners to get the word out. And Secretary Sutters and her team are helping us get the word out across the Commonwealth. Another major focus of our work is scaling up to meet the specific needs of the homeless population. Thanks to Governor Baker and Secretary Sutter's leadership, we're partnering with Boston Healthcare for the Homeless, Pine Street Inn, other shelters, the City of Boston Shelter System, to reopen the East Newton Pavilion to accommodate homeless patients. And I'm pleased to report that we welcomed our first 20 guests last night. We're hopeful that with continued strict social distancing, these efforts, in tandem with the parallel processes at other hospitals, will allow us to both reduce demand and rise up to meet it. In the days ahead, BMC will keep executing our surge plan and building out additional capacity. I want to end on an optimistic note. So far, to knock wood, Boston Medical Center's plan is working well and we're keeping pace, although we know we are not out of the woods. The effort I've seen at our hospital, and one that I know is being replicated at every hospital across our state, has been nothing short of extraordinary. I truly believe that Massachusetts, with the leader of the Baker administration, and Boston, with the leadership of Mayor Walsh, combined with the expertise and empathy of our incredible healthcare teams and strict social distancing practiced by everyone, I'm hopeful that we can beat the odds on this. Thank you.
This is WBUR. You're listening to live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's daily coronavirus briefing at the State House.
And for being a premier Boston safety net hospital. Governor, Lieutenant Governor, thank you. Good afternoon. So just a couple of updates to augment what the governor has said. So specifically on ventilators. We have distributed 109 ventilators across 19 sites throughout the state. As you know, we received a distribution of 100 from the federal government, and then we had 4 from Medtronic, and 5 were donated, as the governor said yesterday, from Boston Children's Hospital. We received another from the stockpile that we're now testing to ensure that they work, and they will be allocating them today. I'll be reviewing the inventory shortly for distribution tomorrow. In addition, we were informed last evening that the governor's advocacy on behalf of the Commonwealth has been successful and that we are to receive another 200 sometime next week. So we received notice that we're getting them. My attitude about this is until they're in the stockpile, we don't count them, but we have received notice that we should receive another 200 early next week. Update on our mobile testing program. As you know, because you've heard me say this before, the command center has been accelerating on-site testing and made resources available, particularly to our long-term care facilities, to prioritize the safety of our most vulnerable residents. Since launching the initiative, more than 27 tests have been collected from about 150 facilities. Today, the National Guard is visiting another 20 locations throughout the state. Yesterday, I announced that the program expanded to include assisted living residences and that for nursing facilities can now request to receive test kits to perform the sample collection, rather than having the National Guard specialist perform the testing on site. So a facility may order test kits for the entire facility, both symptomatic and asymptomatic residents and employees. Today, I'm pleased to announce that we actually started a partnership with the largest EMS provider in New England, and we're now doing mobile testing at some of our very vulnerable group homes for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Transformative Healthcare will visit congregate settings and test our residents for COVID-19. This partnership helps us provide access to timely testing for individuals with disabilities across the Commonwealth without them having to leave their homes for testing. It's very important for our safety net. And just an update on our nursing home call line. As we have said, it really reiterates how the governor ended his remarks. I think one of the hardest decisions I made was in recommending that we stop visitation to long-term care nursing homes and assisted living residences, knowing that at the time when we most want comfort from loved ones, that I was restricting access of love and comfort and hugs to families. So we strongly encourage long-term care facilities to maintain open communication with the families of all of their residents about COVID-19 and how it impacts their facilities and the individuals who live in their assisted living residences, rest homes, and nursing homes. We recognize that communicating with families during this unprecedented public health emergency is crucial, particularly, as I said, since visitation has been so restricted. Improved communication is a key reason why we created a dedicated family resource line specifically for families with concerns. Our nursing home facility resource line, a dedicated phone line to connect family members with the information resources they need, has spoken with over 1,000 people since we launched on Monday. We encourage families and community members who have questions about the nursing home or rest home care their loved one is receiving during the COVID-19 outbreak to utilize this resource. It's available 7 days a week, and that number is 617-660-5399. With that, I'll turn it back to the governor.
Questions for any of us?
Governor, why now did you decide to issue the DPH advisory regarding the face coverings? Why not earlier? And also, will you now reconsider a curfew?
So we issued it because we reviewed the guidance over the course of the week. We talked to a lot of our colleagues in the healthcare world and in local government, and decided based on the feedback we got from them that the guidance was the right thing to do. I said when the guidance was issued by the CDC on Sunday, it's either Saturday or Sunday of last week, that I thought the guidance made a lot of sense. And I said specifically, if you're going to be in a grocery store or a pharmacy or some other place where you can't socially distance, you should wear a mask or a covering because it protects you from others, but it also protects others from you. And the fundamental reason I think this is important as we go forward is the growing body of evidence that is significant. It's a minority as a percent of the total, but a significant minority of the population that becomes infected with COVID-19 never becomes symptomatic, which makes that particularly important. And while I'm not happy about the fact I can't see my dad either, it's that invisibility that comes with this particular virus in a significant number of people that makes this issue associated with visitation in long-term care facilities so important. Because you could very well be a carrier and have absolutely no idea. And that's why that mask or that face covering is important, not just to protect you from others, but also to protect others from you.
And will you be reconsidering the curfew, any sort of curfew?
We've said many times that people should stay home. Stay home. And we've seen a dramatic drop in mobility over the course of the past several weeks. If local communities want to recommend that people not be out at night in their communities, they are free to do that under our guidance.
As we get closer to the surge, though, would you reconsider imposing a mandatory stay-at-home? It might just be for a week or two as we go through the surge.
Everybody in Massachusetts knows they should stay at home. Everyone. And we've seen it in the data over and over again. We've seen it in the polling. We've seen it on the streets. We've seen it pretty much everywhere. And in the places where we haven't seen it, we've acted on it. It's why we changed the guidelines with respect to grocery stores and pharmacies. It's part of why we're talking today about face coverings and masks if you can't socially distance. And it's the main reason we decided to ban parking at many of our, at all of our beaches. And it's why we talked to some of our colleagues in a number of communities about shutting down their parkways, our parkways, their parkways this weekend to make more space available for people to walk. Well, keep in mind that, the BCEC is a really big place. And we put 1,000 beds up there. You could put a lot more if you had to. And remember that the BCEC basically got built out in 5 days. I think the DCU Center got built out in about 5 days. The Joint Base Cape Cod got built out in about 5 days. Yeah, and they can expand too. So I mean, you can add capacity in a pretty big hurry. But part of the reason why we're talking about continuing to grow our community of potential volunteers and skilled clinicians and healthcare workers is in case we need them to deal with issues like that. The build out itself will probably be the part we can do quickest. The piece we got to make sure we figure out is the staff.
This is WBUR. You're listening to live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's coronavirus briefing at the State House.
Well, there's a lot of tasks that are what I would describe as operational that a lot of different people could satisfy. And many of the tasks associated especially with folks who are in a lower level of care, the support activities associated with that, fall into what I would call sort of the orderly category, and there's a lot of people who could be trained to do that.
Governor, a grocery store worker in Salem died of COVID, and Congressman Bolton is calling on the state to maybe provide more PPEs to grocery store frontline workers. Are you considering that? And are you considering maybe opening up some of these drive-thru testing that are open right now to just first responders, also grocery stores?
So the current sites that are open for first responders and emergency medical personnel. And a big part of the reason why we changed our guidance on grocery stores generally and went to the 40% occupancy number and a few of the other elements we did there was specifically to protect not just the people in the grocery store, but the people who work there. And obviously our grocery store workers, the folks working in pharmacies, the folks working on the public transportation system. There are a lot of folks doing a lot of really important jobs out there. And DCF workers who are out visiting families. And I think one of the things we're going to talk about is whether we can figure out a way to enhance our testing capability for others too. So, first of all, everything associated with what happened at Holyoke, a soldier's home, is tragic. And a big part of the reason why, within sort of 48 hours of learning about it, the lieutenant governor and I and the secretary moved to hire an independent investigator was because we wanted answers. And within 12 hours of learning about it, we had folks on the ground there, Valitech and others, to stabilize the situation and to deal with many of the issues that needed to be dealt with for both residents and for staff. And I want to say at this point how much we appreciate the work that was done by Holyoke Medical Center to step up and basically create within 72 hours a COVID facility for COVID-infected residents of the Soldiers' Home at Holyoke Medical Center. And I also want to give a big shout-out to the National Guard, who came in literally the following morning and brought not just active duty guards people, but also brought medical personnel to support the work that we were doing there to stabilize the place. We started our investigation because we want answers, okay? And I think the U.S. Attorney's investigation, he sits in a position where, remember, the entity that does the survey work for the soldiers' homes is the VA, which is a federal entity. So I certainly believe that he's got a position there where a review would be appropriate if he deemed it as such, and we welcome his participation there.
Did the state provide adequate medical care to those veterans?
Well, clearly, by the time our folks, by the time Val and the team showed up there, the place had real problems, and that was obviously demonstrated by what everybody saw there on the ground on Monday. And that's why we're doing the investigation. And by the way, it's why so many things have happened over the course of the past, is that 5 days ago? Yeah, over the course of the past five, was it 5 days or 10, or 12 days ago? It's all one day. I think that's part of the reason why so much has been done over the course of the past 12 days to stabilize the situation and the circumstances for the residents and the staff. Yeah.
Okay. What is your reaction to the lawsuit brought by the representatives of the veteran industry?
So I've answered this question many times with respect to why we made the decision we made. I believe we made the right decision, and I don't speak to questions that are currently before the court. Signed it already. And thank the legislature for getting it done.
Sorry. Do you have a sense of how many people have died at nursing facilities, other facilities across the state? Is it a large percentage of the total?
Well, the person who would have been best equipped to answer that just left. So
she hasn't been answering that question for 3 days. So I'm
yeah. Remember, we provide that we provide most of the information around death certificates goes to the local boards of health, and they are, for all intents and purposes, the keepers of most of that data. And we've made clear to them that they can make information in their communities available. With respect to what the DPH actually collects from the locals, I'll have to get back to you on that one. We are about to enter what will probably be the most difficult period we are going to face in dealing with this particular virus at this particular time. Period. Our energies, our focus, our efforts, and our daily work are about making sure that our healthcare community and our service community, social service, first responders, shelter providers, all the rest, have the capacity and the staff that they need to ensure that we do everything we can on behalf of the people who are going to find their way into the shelter or the healthcare system over the course of the next several weeks. Any plan associated with what happens after that is going to be based on the facts on the ground and a tremendous amount of guidance that will need to come from public health experts and others about testing and tracing and other elements of what you know, a so-called safe reopening could look like. But I don't want people to get ahead of themselves on this one, okay? We are about to have a very difficult couple of weeks here in Massachusetts. And it could be 3 weeks and it could be four, depending upon how this whole thing plays out. People have put a ton of work into preparing for this so that we do everything we can to make sure that not only are we able to serve the people who are going to be dealing with COVID-19, but that we are able to make sure our healthcare system can continue to take care of the people who have the incidents and the illnesses and the heart attacks and everything else that happen every single day in Massachusetts. One of the biggest challenges other countries have faced when they've gone through the surge is not just managing the surge itself, but the impact that surge has on its ability to actually service people who have solvable problems who can't get taken care of. Our goal is to make sure that we get enough capacity in place that we can continue to do the things we've always done on behalf of people when they needed it and take care of people who are dealing with COVID as part of the surge. That's our focus, that should be our focus, and that should be what people in Massachusetts are thinking about. If you're looking for something to pray for this weekend, you should be praying for the families and the neighbors and the friends who are going to be working their way through this surge over the next several weeks, whether they are healthcare workers or patients or hospital leaders or just folks in the community who are volunteering to step up and help with some of the ancillary issues associated with food or shelter or whatever it might be. We'll start talking about other stuff eventually, but the focus right now really needs to be on what's right in front of us. And what's right in front of us is going to be a very difficult few weeks in managing something that's never happened before here in Massachusetts.
This is WBUR. You're listening to live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's daily coronavirus briefing at the State House.
Yeah. I mean, I said before, I don't like making decisions on small pieces of data. But if you look at the sort of way these lines go, right, if you succeed, what you do is you take a line that looks like that in terms of hospitalizations and cases, and you turn it into a line that looks more like this, right? Now, if you take a line that goes more like this, one of the things that potentially happens with it is it moves out a little bit and comes down a little farther out than you might have expected it to. And there's some indication that our line is kind of trending in that direction. But it's good, but it basically means, once again, that the focus for the time being really needs to be on dealing with what's directly in front of us. And we'll get around to talking about the other stuff. What we're doing, I mean, part of what the Secretary Sutter's talked about was, I think there are about 100, and there are roughly 1,000 senior care facilities of one kind or another in Massachusetts. If you count the assisted living facilities and the nursing homes and the elder care facilities, it's about 1,000. There are about 140 of them that have at least one case of COVID-19. And that mobile testing unit has been to almost all of them. And it typically goes to when a facility tells us that they either believe they have a case or they have a case, that mobile testing unit shows up and tests everybody who's had close contact with the individuals who are involved, turns it around in 24 hours, and then works with the epidemiologists at DPH to give the facility and infectious control people to give the facility guidance on how to deal with it at that point going forward. It's been a fairly successful tool at helping facilities manage this sort of thing. First, I've heard of that for from a community level. But if they have the testing capability available, and that's the best way they believe to put it to work, that's certainly an option.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Have a nice weekend. Well, I'll probably see you tomorrow.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and you've been listening to live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's daily coronavirus briefing from the State House. We have a foreshortened Week in Review coming out of that daily press briefing, but fortunately, our panelists for the Week in Review were both listening and are able to join me now on the line. First, we have Renee Graham of the Boston Globe, a columnist there and a WBUR contributor. Welcome back, Renee.
Thank you.
Also joining us on the line is Ed Lyons. He's a Massachusetts Republican activist and a political writer. Welcome back to you, Ed.
Thanks for having me back.
So I'm glad you both had an opportunity to listen to the governor. There were a number of headlines there. A couple of the key things that I heard, he talked about the surge that he's been anticipating between April 10th and 20th. Probably now, he says, a little closer to April 20th. A lot of data on testing. Positive rate testing rates seem to have been averaging around 30% per day this week. Fatality rate is now up at 2.7%, although that is still below the national average. Not a lot of information about the number of beds available, et cetera. But let's start just by asking each of you to give us sort of your reactions and highlights from the governor just now. Renee, why don't you go first?
I think the thing that jumped out for me was when he mentioned that there were 2,500 positive cases yesterday, and that was the biggest one-day total in the state. You know, I think the reason why he kept drilling down on that and just to let people know, this is not over. You know, you still have to stay at home. You still need to practice social distancing. And above and beyond everything else, just stay home unless you absolutely positively have to be in the street. And I really felt that sort of throughout today's press conference, he really kept trying to drill that home for people. It's not like we're going to have the surge and then it's all going to be great. We can go back to our normal lives. And I think what he's saying is that this is, you know, we're looking at something that's going to be here for the long haul.
Ed, how about you?
Well, I just felt great pride in our state. I just to see the governor, the legislature, and our healthcare community come together like this and prepare for war. And they just seem like that they are ready. And I feel very grateful that they're all doing this.
Listeners, pull up a chair. What were your reactions to the governor's press conference just now? What have you been following this week in the news about the coronavirus here in the Commonwealth? Thoughts, your ideas? Pull up a chair and join us in the conversation. The number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ed and Renee, one of the things that I keyed in on was the governor's reporting on the number of beds that we've got available and how we're scaling up. He says we've got 11,000 beds available between acute care and ICU now, and looking to add another 3,500 fairly quickly. The BCEC Mobile Hospital opened today. Those feel like big numbers, but it's also hard to get my head around what a lot is, because normal, you know, sort of everyday people don't follow our hospital and healthcare capacity in the state. What are your reactions to the size and scale of those numbers?
You know, I think it's interesting. You know, we live in a state that is very much well known for its wonderful medical facilities, and suddenly we're hearing that we might not have enough to get through this. So when you're talking about building field hospitals and needing to get more beds and to get more volunteers and staff into these places, you know, it's sort of sobering to give you an idea of what it's like to even be in an area that is well equipped, but not well equipped enough for a pandemic.
And Ed, he said that right now we're at 55% of our capacity, leaving 45% of the available beds in the Commonwealth for this surge. Does that seem like it will be enough? Do you have some hope that maybe we don't experience, for example, what New York State has experienced?
Well, I think we're learning from what they experienced. And I'm really glad that the governor has changed the conversation from just the spreading and the numbers to, you know, can we take care of the people we need to take care of? I thought he was excellent, keeping the focus on the size of our healthcare services. I think it's wonderful that the woman from Boston Medical is talking about serving all groups equally, that having equity. I think a lot of people around the world are going to look back and say, boy, you know, some people suffer from this far more, and that was not what our values were. It seems like Massachusetts is really making sure that the response effort is meeting our values, and I think that was great.
Okay, there's one more thing I want to key in on the debrief of the governor, and then we'll take a quick break and come back. When he was asked towards the end of the brief by a reporter, sort of what are the plans coming out of this, he seemed to get angry. And was very clear in an extended and adamant answer that that is not the thing to be focusing on right now. That was striking to me in that I couldn't tell if that meant there isn't planning for later going on or if that's just not what he wants to be talking about.
I thought it was what he didn't want to be talking about. I mean, you know, he talked a lot about surge planning and the need to, you know, hope for the best, but plan for the worst. But I don't think we still have a clear sense of what that really means. And I thought that's what the reporter was trying to suss out of the governor, of what does that really mean? And I'm not sure. I think the plans are almost developing day by day, and he didn't have an answer. And so in a somewhat typical way, he got testy in his question, in his answer.
Let's pick up a call. The lines are already full. So let's bring Tricia into the conversation from Arlington. Hi, Tricia.
Hello, good afternoon, everyone. I'm supporting the governor. Everyone needs to understand distancing is important. I live in the Housing Corporation of Arlington Housing, and there are people here still not abiding by these rules of distancing. There's been company going in and out, and I want to remind all the citizens that we have personal responsibility in this matter.
Thanks for that, Tricia. Let's add one more call. We've got Carol on the line from Norton, Massachusetts. Hi, Carol.
Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to just say, firstly, that I wanted to thank WBUR and also to thank Governor Baker for his fabulous leadership. I had to put today's on mute for a moment, so I'm not sure if he addressed this, but I was calling with a positive story about unemployment. And I know that everybody's been very, very nervous and anxious about getting onto unemployment. I actually experienced a little bit, tiny bit of frustration, but after about a week, I was able to apply. But my story is mainly about a callback I got from a guardian angel who works up in the Tingsboro office. I'm not allowed to give out her name, but I'd like to have her recognized eventually. She called me and spent 45 minutes on the phone with me, making sure that everything was just right, answered every single question I had, and told me that I should contact her email if I had any other questions. And I wanted to, mainly in all of these negative stories, I wanted to tell a positive story that on Wednesday, right before my Passover Seder, I was able to sit and enjoy it, of course, remotely, because of this fabulous woman's experience, care, empathy, and guidance.
Thank you for that, Carol. I am a huge fan of the shout-outs, so I don't know who you are in Tingsboro that did such great customer service with Carol.
I am in Norton.
I know. No, I'm saying to the person you're shouting out to, we don't know her name, but she's in Tingsboro, and she did a great job for you, Carol, and we're glad to have it. We did hear, Renee and Ed, from the governor, I believe it was yesterday, that they had returned 60,000 phone calls about unemployment insurance, and we're trying to dial up that customer service. How do we get our head around the amount of customer service response that the government is responsible for in the Commonwealth right now? Ed.
Well, I think we take pride in the state about the safety net we have and serving people. I think this is going to be a great test to say, well, how well are people being served? If we have these programs, are they being administered properly? There should be some effort to see, you know, are we delivering on our promises to people? I don't know, but I hope we find out more about that.
And Renee, there's such a yin and yang here because we are hearing some really strong stories about the speed, the rate at which the Commonwealth is scaling up administratively in terms of healthcare capacity, et cetera. We also heard the governor get a question today about the fact that the U.S. Attorney's Office is going to launch its own investigation into the soldier's home in Holyoke. How and when will we know how well we're doing overall here in the Commonwealth?
I don't think we're going to have a true sense of it until we're on the other side of this, because it's happening in real time. It's hard to, you know, I don't think it's the time for anyone to be patting themselves on the back or, you know, doing victory laps. You know, we don't even know if we're near the middle of this thing. So I don't think we're going to have a better sense of how it's all gone until later on. You know, in the same way that we're looking at certain numbers, whether you're talking about number of deaths or The unemployment numbers, we still don't know. We know that the unemployment numbers are probably larger because there's still thousands of people who can't get through in the state, you know, who've given up. So whatever the numbers are, I always say to people, you should probably add maybe another 25 to 50% on top of that, because we still don't know how many people are falling through the cracks because the system wasn't built for this kind of deluge of attention.
All right, Renee Graham of the Boston Globe and Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist. It's Friday, so it's our Week in Review. We actually are foreshortened on the Week in Review today because in the first half of the hour, we brought you live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's daily coronavirus briefing, and we were just debriefing that before the break with our panelists. We have with us still Renee Graham, Boston Globe columnist and a WBUR contributor, and Ed Lyons, a Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. We also have you. Let's take more of your calls. What do you make of this week's news? How are you holding up in this crisis? Where are you finding comfort? How are you feeling about the surge that Governor Baker is now saying, well, it'll still come between April 10th and April 20th, maybe a little closer to April 20th? Call us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Just before the break, Renee, you made a comment about the fact that you tell people whatever the number we think we have is, double it, right, or add another 40 or 50%. I want to pick up on that because I want to start looking at the news of the week now. We're also hearing, we've heard from numerous officials in Chelsea that that city is a new hotspot for the virus. When Mary Lou Sutters was asked at one of the briefings earlier this week where the hotspots were, Chelsea was one that she named. Chelsea's now confirming more than 400 cases there, and some officials are calling for a 24-hour curfew. Here is Chelsea City Council President Roy Avellaneda speaking to WBZ TV about the situation there. Okay, so
higher than New York. What you're not knowing and what we're finding out, and I'm just finding out, is there's a lot of people not being tested, and so it's a lot worse. And so that 400 isn't really a 400 number. It's probably, you know, three times that.
So in a hot spot area like Chelsea, Mary Lou Sutters had also mentioned Brockton and I believe Revere. How do we get a sense of the numbers? It's really concerning to have the city council president saying three times that we need to curfew. Ed.
Well, then the Chelsea government can do that. Governor Baker did say that, you know, municipalities, you know, can do more than the state is recommending. So I would hope, I actually know some on the city council in Chelsea. I hope that they get on this, because if things are different there, they should respond differently.
Renee, I want to get some reaction from you to that.
I mean, I think the most obvious thing is we're never going to have a sense of how big this is until testing is available to everyone. Until people can get tests on demand, there's a lot of guesswork in here. You know, what we're hearing about in Chelsea, and it was my Globe colleague, Marcela Garcia, who wrote about this in the column a few days ago, is that you have people who aren't getting the information, who in a lot of cases are in jobs where they can't work at home. So they're still taking mass transit. They're still gathering at bus stops to get to work. They're going out every single day. And meanwhile, they're being told not to. And that's increasing the virus. And we don't know what those numbers really are, because a lot of those people are not in a position to get tested, A, because they don't have the healthcare access to do it, and also because the tests just aren't that readily available.
So I want to stay on this for a minute. The U.S. Census, according to the U.S. Census, about 70% of Chelsea's residents are either self-identified as Hispanic or Latinx. And we are hearing a great deal about racial disparity in COVID-19 around the country. Just from what we know, and we have incomplete numbers here in Boston, more than 40% of those infected here in Boston are Black, even though Black residents make up only about 25% of the population. We're hearing about a hotspot in Chelsea. And just by a point of comparison, about 28% of coronavirus patients in Boston are white, despite making up about 45% of the city's population. We've heard increased conversation this week about the racial disparities. What to make of that? What are your reactions? Renee, I know you wrote about this today.
I did. You know what I said in the column, and I can't reiterate it enough. These numbers are shocking, but they're not at all surprising. There were lots of people, there were lots of advocates, there were lots of Black and Latino doctors who were talking about this as we were starting to move into the pandemic, that this was going to hit vulnerable communities more. And we're seeing exactly what was predicted. So I don't think anyone should be terribly surprised. And it's not that there's a genetic predisposition on the part of Black and Latino people to get the virus. It's all the other conditions that exist, the structural racism that has been sustained in this country for decades and really centuries, always comes down hardest on the people who are most vulnerable. That's what's happening. So you have people who are in low-income housing, don't have insurance, don't have ready access to medical care, who work in jobs that require that they leave the house, who live in more congested quarters where they're living with more people, they're living in apartment buildings, they're renters, so there's a lot of interaction there outside of a small group of people. So all of those things, which are, again, sustained by racism in this country, are contributing to these really horrific numbers we're seeing in communities of color.
So, Ed, what we have then is a tension that it is centuries of institutionalized racism leading to the disparity that we're experiencing by race in COVID-19 now, and a pandemic that is immediately on us and that we do not have centuries to respond to. So what are the public policy measures that the Commonwealth needs to put in place immediately in order to address the reality of the disparity we're experiencing?
Well, I don't think we can do anything right in the next couple of weeks to address long-term racism, but we actually don't really have all the answers on why we're seeing this disparity. It could be that non-whites live more in dense areas. It could be that they make up a larger percentage of the essential workforce that is still going to work. Perhaps whites are more overrepresented in people who can work from home. I mean, there are clusters of low-income non-whites who live in New Bedford and Fall River, and they're not being racked with this. So I don't think that we have the answers yet. I think it's great that the state is tracking this. I think it's great that we have people in hospitals focusing on equity. I think it's great that the Monica, what name is it, Bartel, the woman who's in charge of the State Public Health Commission, she has a background in serving disadvantaged communities and healthcare. I think a lot of people are working for equity. I think that is the most important thing right now. And then when we have a clearer picture of why this disparity is happening, then we can address that at the other side of the surge.
Monica Burrell there, I just wanted to note. So I want to bring another voice in who also has an opinion. On what needs to happen now. This is Dr. Joseph Betancourt, who was on the show earlier this week, Vice President and Chief of Equity and Inclusion at Massachusetts General Hospital. And he said, we need information and trust.
Information is paramount, and information to our communities is absolutely critical. Ultimately, given our nation's history of racism, discrimination, segregation, medical experimentation, many communities of color have a long history of mistrust, and as a result, they need individuals who they feel are trustworthy, incredible sources of information, and they need to get culturally competent and high quality and respectful care when they come into our healthcare system.
So on this subject, Renee, last word before I go to some callers, where are the trustworthy sources of information right now? Where do people turn?
I think Dr. Fauci is a place to go. But I think that the part of the issue is so often you will hear political officials say, well, for more information, go to cdc.gov. Well, you can only do that if you have access to a computer. There has to be a way. I know the city of Boston has certainly stepped up, and Mayor Walsh has been calling, you know, these sort of automated calls to let people know where services are, to remind people to socially distance and to stay at home. There has to be a way, and they have it in multiple languages, which is also very important because there are parts of the Commonwealth where there are not English speakers, and they're still going to be affected, and they shouldn't be punished because they don't speak English. They need this information. They need to know how to take care of themselves and their family. So I think there are ways that they're trying to do that. There just needs to be much more of it. You can't just have it as, you know, log on and find it, because not everyone can do that. That's what we found with the stay-at-home orders. Not everyone could stay at home because they didn't have the technology to allow them to do that. I think that there has to be an increased and concerted effort on the part of state and city officials to get the message out there to all parts of the Commonwealth, not just to the people who would normally get it.
All right, let's pick up some calls. We've got Kelly on the line from Uxbridge, Massachusetts. Hey, Kelly, what's on your mind?
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to comment just on, well, I want to commend Governor Baker for standing in front of us every day and passing on the information, the data, the facts out to the community. I'm sure that he and local government, as well as healthcare workers, everybody is just exhausted with this because it's a day in, day out thing that we are dealing with. But one of the comments that I had is in regards to some of the small town communities I'm seeing almost on a daily basis comments being circulated around social media where people are still not really taking this very seriously. And it's disheartening to see the comments that are rolling in of people who are saying they're still going to have their backyard barbecues and they're still going to get together, and that, you know, this in a small town where there are, I think, 13 cases right now, it's not even, you know, you can't even compare to some of the hot spots in the cities. People are just taking this too lightly, I think. And I hope in hearing him answer that question, I could feel that energy in his voice. I could sense his, you know, the sternness, and, you know, he sounded almost angry at that question, what the woman asked, when are we going to get back to, when are we
going to
open up?
I am so sorry to interrupt you, but I want to make sure to be able to get a couple other caller voices in here, too. I think we've got the idea there, and I appreciate you calling in with that frustration about communities that are still not taking the social distancing seriously. Let's get one other call in. At least we've got Robert from Townsend. Robert, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. What I've been paying attention to this week is the fact that other countries are knocking down this infection spread by requiring, or at least encouraging everyone to wear a cloth mask. We're talking about people who have to live close quarters or have to go, you know, out and work in essential jobs. And if people would just assume that they could be a carrier and wear a cloth mask, it could cut down transmission a great deal.
Thank you for that,
people,
Robert. And I will say the Surgeon General has a good instruction video out there, 30 seconds to make a cloth mask. I've tried it. I wore it today when I got to the office, and it totally works. So you can check out the Surgeon General on that. Renee and Ed, we've got about 2 minutes left, and there's so much left to talk about. But I think where I want to go next is to just ask each of you, what is the story right now? Where are we in the Commonwealth on the pandemic, and what should everybody be thinking about and focusing on right now? Ed?
I think we should listen to what Governor Baker said, that it's time to focus on the problems in front of us, and that by staying home and following the guidelines is the most important thing we can do. Even though Easter and Passover are coming, and I thought it was great you talked about faith, that it's important to do the right thing as individuals, and that will make the whole system work better. That's what we should be focusing on.
Renee, how about you? What do you think?
I think it's the same thing. I think, you know, worry less about when you can get back to your parties and when you can go out to the theater, and think about what you can do to get through this situation safety and sanity. You have to take care of yourselves and take care of your neighbors. And the only way to do that is through social distancing and staying at home.
And so we've got about 35 seconds left now. So what will it take till everybody reads the urgency of this situation the same? Both of you.
I don't know. I mean, I think there are always going to be people who think it's an exaggeration. I think that there's this sort of dissonance that's happening between, say, Massachusetts and a state like Mississippi, where, you know, things are still going on and people are still packing churches. I think there almost has to be a national effort. I don't know, maybe declaration of a national stay-at-home order, which has not been forthcoming, to maybe convince the most recalcitrant people that they need to do more.
And Ed?
We don't need everyone to do this. We need almost everyone to do this. And we have to try as hard as we can. We should not. Humanity is a messy business. Let's just try to do as much as we can.
All right. That's Ed Lyons. He's a Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Thanks, Ed.
Thank you.
And Renee Graham, Boston Globe columnist and a WBUR contributor. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. That is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director, with engineering today by Glenn Alexander. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering, and I do hope you will join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.